Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives. The author is Ellen Brown, and it is a book that everyone should read. In the solution area, we have tapped into a number of sources and resources, in particular the Thrive Movement website, thrivemovement.com. We specifically investigated into the top 10 actions, what you can do in terms of solutions. Those, as a brief review, are 1. Get informed, speak up, and connect with others. 2. Bank locally. 3. Buy and invest responsibly. 4. Join the movement to audit and end the Federal Reserve. 5. Keep the internet fair and open. 6. Support independent media. 7. Support organic non-GMO farming. 8. Require election and campaign finance reform. 9. Advocate for renewable and free energy. And 10. Take part in critical mass action. And I'd like to branch out to another issue in the life and debt area, and that's related to health. Today I'm going to have an audio interview from internationally renowned natural health physician and Mercola.com founder, Dr. Joseph Mercola. He's interviewing Ellen Brown, who is the civil litigation attorney and author of The Web of Debt, which we have gone very deeply into. And he's going to talk to her about the politics of health as well as forbidden medicine. And it, of course, relates to the big central banking issues that confront us. You can actually watch this on the YouTube. Dr. Mercola interviews Ellen Brown about politics of health. And this will be a continuation of the last show. And it will bring out a lot more details related to banks.
Yeah, it's just shocking what they've been able to come up with now. We have published, and with respect to the cancer, suppression of the cancer information and the really the massive amount of injustice and that is occurring in this area, is sort of a highlight of this that represents this pretty well is what they've done to Dr. Brzezinski. And in sharing his story, there's a number of individuals that we've documented and shown on videos or people have done through, like Cut, Poison, and Burn, which is a really great documentary that shows how perverted the system has become, so that as parents, if your child has this cancer and you go against what the conventional medical model is. The state has the authority to actually go in and take that child away from you, not only that child, but all your children, because they think you're being an unfit parent. I mean, it is just shocking what type of abuse has been and perversion is able to occur through the legal system. So I wonder if you can comment on that as an attorney.
Right. As those cases go back, I think, to, you know, there were cases of sort of cults that didn't believe in any sort of treatment, and they would just let the child basically, you know, catch like an ordinary infection and die because they wouldn't get treatment. And that's where maybe they were Jehovah's Witnesses, I'm not sure, but it was more like religious cults, and that's where these legal cases came up from. But it's true, you yourself have the right to choose what treatment you get. You can say no if you're an adult. You may not be able to get your treatment covered under insurance, and that's another way that the cartel has won. That even though you want to go to an alternative practitioner, you think I can't afford it. Now, in truth, the alternative is much cheaper than the conventional, but the conventional is supposedly covered by insurance, whereas the alternative isn't. So it's one more charge that you have to pay. But anyway, as a parent, the children. Have to follow the standard in the trade type thing, the conventional medicine. So if you have a child with cancer and you don't want to go through the conventional things, I mean, first of all, I think the first thing you should do is get a lot of second opinions, because there you read a lot of cases of where they'll say that the child is worse than the child really is because they want to get the person in a drug study or something. You know, I mean, you can't necessarily trust the opinion of your first doctor. So there are different things you can do, but right now the law is against the parent trying to exercise the right of choice.
So I wonder also if you could, one of the movements and directions we're going into now is health activism, and to really help increase health liberty in this country. And we're actually working with an attorney friend of yours, Charlie Brown, in the freedom of dental mercury amalgam. So I'm wondering if you, from your perspective as an attorney, if you could provide us with your top three recommendations, what the average individual could be doing right now to win this war on health, freedom, and liberty.
Well, I think the first thing you need to do, most people get interested because they have a health problem of their own. And so the first thing you want to do is get on the internet and research heavily what's gone before, what your legal rights are, what the downsides of the drug treatment that they're trying to recommend for this condition. And then we really seriously need to get organized. I was in the alternative healthcare movement for a long time. And it seemed to me that the medical doctors were all sort of literally brainwashed. I mean, I read a book on this, that brainwashing is where they keep you up all night, you know, because you have to do your rounds and whatever. And then you're sort of force-fed information. I mean, you want to pass this test. So you haven't had enough sleep, and you're looking at this data, and it says, all right, you give this drug for this condition, and you just accept that because you're like sort of dazed in medical school. So anyway, the doctors are all trained in one discipline. They all testify in favor of each other. They won't testify against each other in court. And so they're just like this strong wall of solidarity versus all the alternative people were all like mavericks and geniuses in their way, but they all thought the others were quacks. And so they were actually shooting at each other. It's rather like the Democrats, you know, that always destroy themselves before they even get to the... we need to, in some way, form a movement where we have to just agree on some basics and worry about the details later. We need like a big tent, a big umbrella that accepts that we're going to maybe not agree on the right therapy, but what we do agree on is that drugs, cut, burn, and poison is the wrong approach, that it works against the body. We want something that supports the body, that helps the body do what it's trying to do.
I'd like to take a moment for station identification. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And now we will continue the interview by Dr. Mercola of Ellen Brown about politics of health, which includes banking concepts.
Another thing is the cost. American medicine is the costliest in the world, and we do not get the best results. Body-supporting therapies are cheaper than the things that are actually trying to block what the body's trying to do, and those things that block what the body's trying to do make you unhealthier, which means you have to have more treatment, which means you're hospitalized more often, which means you run up more bills. I mean, we could save a lot of money if we had a sort of package. If our whole approach was to support what the body's trying to do, the natural treatments, it would be much cheaper for the whole country. We cannot afford our health care right now, so something has to be done about this whole parasitic. There's a parasitic banking system and a parasitic medical system and a parasitic insurance scheme that is just draining the profits out of our economy.
I couldn't agree more, and I think, as we'll discuss later in the interview, some of the issues with the banking system, which is really one of your expertise. It appears that, you know, this process can't proceed unending. It has to collapse and fail at some point. And when it does, there's going to be this massive motivation and incentive to identify cost-effective strategies, because we have limited resources, and at some point this, you know, money's going to be an issue. It isn't now, because they just keep on printing it and making the problem worse. But I like your idea of coming together, and we've seen a recent example of the effectiveness of this, because the other point that's implied but that wasn't mentioned by you is that they really outnumber us, at least financially and power-wise. I mean, they have almost all the power in all the finances. We outnumber them massively in people, in numbers. So it, there's this distortion even though we are larger in number, there's this incredible disagreement among us. And I think it's a phenomenal suggestion, is that we need to come to a consensus and realize who the real enemy is. And it's happening in the California ballot initiative, where we're seeking to have labeling requirements, and a number of the key leaders in this area really don't agree on everything. I mean, we're aligned with our Organic Consumers Associations, is one of the two big leading forces, and certainly there's others. But, you know, we love them, but, you know, we have different views on many positions. But we are absolutely in a complete alignment that we need to take this direction to be effective. So I think it's a marvelous idea, and I think we need to take more in that direction and learn from this experience. Mm-hmm. And just a brief comment, too, on the sort of the brainwashing that occurs during medical training, especially residency, where you're sleep-deprived and you're kind of force-fed these processes. You know, another part of that is even more foundational is the industry's control of the publishing process, which lends to the point that you were making earlier about the restriction of information. Because the scientific method is viewed as the ultimate way that we can prove truth. Well, yes, in theory, but it's been perverted with massive conflict of interest, and the peer review committee is literally populated completely with individuals who are committed to this paradigm and unwilling to accept anything out of it for the most part, and the studies that are submitted to them are financed for the most part by the industry, and they'll never submit something that shows that they're wrong. I mean, why would they? And even when they do show positive results, I mean, it's frequently data that's been manipulated, and it's not even true. So I mean, this whole process is just, you know, because as a naive medical student, you believe that science is going to win out every time, and in theory it works, but the practical reality is there's been such collusion and corruption and and conflict of interest that it's just impossible in contemporary times almost to get to the truth if you're in that model.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. We have to go on the offensive and disprove their theories. If we try to prove ours, we're all going to disagree on what our theory is. But if our big tent is to expose the prevailing model and show that it's completely faulty, way too expensive, and that it's making us sicker instead of healthier, then we can move in with what the alternatives are.
Yeah, I like that recommendation. It makes a lot of sense. And I think as leaders in the movement, we need to move in that direction. So let's talk a bit about the banking system, because you're the president of the Public Banking Institute. So I'm wondering if you can explain what your institute does and why you believe it's a powerful element of the solution to address the incredible debacle of what has happened to our financial institution in this country, and actually worldwide. It's not certainly restricted to the United States.
Well, I said when the whole system collapsed in 2008, fall of 2008, after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the banking system collapsed, and I was aware that there was one state that actually escaped the credit crisis, and that was the only state that had a publicly owned bank. It's North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota is owned by the state. They've had this bank in place since 1919. And it's they instituted, it was a populist movement that got the bank adopted then. The farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street banks. And again, it was the Rockefeller cartel. The Rockefeller bank owned the railroad, which owned the granaries. So it was all one chain. And the farmers were losing their farms to this out-of-state entity that they had no control over. So they decided they wanted to keep their money in the state, use it for local purposes. So instead of allowing Wall Street to leverage their money into more money, which was then basically invested against them, speculating against them, they could use their own money, leverage it in the same way locally to support their own local economy. And that has worked extremely well. So as in fall of 2008, first there were four states that escaped, and then there were three, and then there were two, and then there were one, and it was North Dakota. So I kept writing about this, and I got overwhelmed with email, and somebody suggested that I start a Google group, which I did, and we all, it just became so active. There were a couple hundred members, and we were all arguing all the time about what was really going on with the banking system, and so we were all kind of motivating each other to peer in and see what was really going on and how we could fix the system. So in the course of all that, I came to the conclusion that the way we could fix the system is that what's wrong with it is basically the interest, that private banks are always siphoning off this extra money that they don't create. But if you have a public system, if banking were a public utility, if credit were a public utility, just like water should be, or electricity, or highways, you know, these are all the blood systems of the economy. So if money and credit were considered a public utility owned by the public, then the interest would go back to the public. That is a sustainable system. And the original model is the Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania owned its own bank. So they both printed money the way all the colonies did, but some of the colonies just printed and hyperinflated their economies. But in Pennsylvania, they had a bank, so they lent the money, and the money came back to the government, and the interest was sufficient to fund the government. So during that period, they paid no taxes, they had no government debt, and prices did not inflate. It was a sustainable model until they were shut down by the Bank of England, by the King of England. And then we had a revolution, et cetera. So we've got the original model right here in the U.S., even though right now most public banks are foreign, like the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. 40% of banks globally are publicly owned, and they are largely in those four countries, which are also the countries that are showing the phenomenal growth in the last 10 years or so. They all escaped the credit crisis, just like North Dakota did.
I'd like to take a moment for station identification. For those just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the interview by Dr. Mercola of Ellen Brown.
So 40% of international banks are publicly owned.
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't know that either until I did a whole lot of research. That's the thing, you keep uncovering these. So now I'm writing another book on public banking.
That's fascinating.
Historically and internationally.
So the obvious question is in 1918, thankfully, the people of North Dakota had enough insight and wisdom to take this approach. But they clearly weren't the only community in the whole country that was under the same influences that caused them to make that choice. So why do you think other states didn't follow their actions? Because it would seem, in retrospect, clearly the wisest move.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, they kept a very low profile, and I think that's why they got away with it. Australia did it brilliantly well, but they talked too much, and they got, they did have a very good, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia was publicly owned for most of the 20th century, and it did do really good things, but the head of the bank died suddenly after he talked too much in London. And in New Zealand, it was the same thing. They had a brilliant model. They got shut down by the Bank of England. So it's only the small places that don't talk about it that get away with it.
Sort of under the radar.
Yeah.
And do you believe it's related to the fact that these banking interests or industries may have the most control of any organization in the world? Because there's so much power and finances at stake, they have effective ways to eliminate their upcoming competition.
Right. If you have the power to create money, you've got the power.
Now, your process that evolved out of that, you developed this Return to Prosperity plan. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that and let us know what that's all about.
40% of the cost of everything we buy is interest. That's according to the research of Margaret Kennedy, who's a German researcher. You don't see it. You don't feel like you're paying interest. But at every stage of development of a product, interest is paid, because the way businesses work is they have to get a loan in order to pay their workers and materials before they have a product to sell. So it's all done on credit, and there's always interest attached to credit. So she calculated that 40% of everything we buy and 40% of public projects are interest. So if the state owned the bank or the city or the county or any public body, you could have community-owned banks, but the trouble is when you start getting too small, it's hard to meet all the requirements. But a state, for example, is so well capitalized, and you know, it has such a huge deposit base. If the state itself, in North Dakota, the state's revenues by law go into the Bank of North Dakota, so they have a huge deposit base and a huge capital base, so they don't have to worry about the Bank for International Settlements. Well, anyway, I won't get into that. So if the state or the public body owns the bank, then we, the people, get the interest back. So mm-hmm. That means the state could save 40% on its projects, which means either that we could cut taxes by 40% or that we could have 40% more services provided with the same amount of taxes that we pay now. We just have to change bankers. Instead of banking with Wall Street, we should be banking in our own bank, where we get the profits, a cooperative system where it all comes back. Banking, instead of feeding off the economy, should feed the economy, and it could be a sustainable system.
And it's even worse than that. I wonder if you can comment, because the original reason that I contacted you was I watched one of your YouTube videos, and it was very compelling presentation. I'm not sure where, but really was addressing the fact that this interest rate is going to decimate us, and it is just going exponentially off the chart. And it's exactly what you're saying. Now it's 40%, but it's going to be over 100%. I mean, if you follow the graph, and it's addressing that interest rate that essentially doesn't exist in North Dakota, because they're paying themselves the interest. So I wonder if you can comment on that, because to me it was a fascinating part of your presentation.
Yeah, Canada did that from 1939 to 1974. They funded their government through their own Bank of Canada, which meant that the interest went back to the government. So it was basically interest-free borrowing. And during those 35 years, they set up this remarkable healthcare system, healthcare for all. They built sea railways and roadways and just all sorts of development all across the country. And they did not, in their federal debt the whole time remained very low. They did not increase their debt because the things they invested in were self-funding. Like if you buy, let's say you build a roadway and you charge tolls, then the tolls can pay for the thing, or a seaway or whatever. But if you have to pay interest on it, then you could be paying for years more than if you only have to pay the principal, which is quite reasonable and manageable. So the model's been proved there in Australia and New Zealand. Right now it's being proven in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. They're all doing that. So we could do it too. If the Federal Reserve were allowed to lend directly to the government, which it's not, it has to buy bonds on the open market just like everybody else, which means they go through banks, which means they pay interest. So the bonds always pay interest. But the bonds could be interest-free if we funded through our own central bank, if we owned the central bank for starters. Of course, the Federal Reserve isn't really federal.
And your speculation as to why this obvious long-term wise approach isn't being implemented is because it would not benefit the bankers, essentially. And
right.
That's where all the power is, so why would they do something against their own self-interest?
Right. Starting in 1974 in Canada, even though they actually own their central bank, I mean, we don't even own ours because the Federal Reserve is composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. The citizens of the United States do not own one share of stock in the Federal Reserve branches. But in Canada, they actually own the Bank of Canada, but still they weren't borrowing from the bank because Canada joined the G10 nations, which are now the G20 nations, there was the Basel Committee, which set up these guidelines where the whole idea was to supposedly prevent inflation. But the way you prevented inflation was governments weren't allowed to print their own money, and they weren't allowed to borrow from their own central banks, which meant they had to borrow privately on the presumption that they were borrowing existing money. But in fact, that's where the flaw in the theory was, that you're not borrowing existing money. Every time you take out a loan, you're borrowing new money, but you're paying interest on it. If you're the government, either you should be issuing it outright, which you could prevent inflation by taking it back in taxes, or you should be borrowing from your own bank and not having to pay interest on it.
Now, you've developed another campaign, which is the Move Your Money campaign. And I'm wondering if you could describe how you that intertwines with the Return to Prosperity plan.
Yeah, well, I didn't develop the Move Your Money. Ours is called Move Our Money.
Oh, okay.
And the difference is we're talking about the big money, the state's money.
Okay.
It's a good idea to move into your local bank with your own deposits, but that doesn't really have a huge impact on Wall Street because, first of all, right now they've got $1.6 trillion in excess reserves since the Fed's been doing all this quantitative easing.
And that was created out of thin air, right? Didn't exist.
And we will continue with the rest of the show in our next presentation. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.